Today we turn a big page in the church year as we transition from Epiphany to the complicated but wonderful season of Lent. Now, Lent is my favorite time of year because it is truly the opportunity to hit the reset button on our lives, and our Christian lives in particular. And unlike the weeks leading to Christmas, the culture has no idea what we're doing. That is a wonderful thing. Lent belongs to us. Lent is truly for the church, by the church. Sometimes we need something outside of us to remind us of our daily need for the Lord's presence and for a more deliberate time of study and prayer. Someone will say, well, we always need to do that. Well, of course we do, but we don't. So Lent is our opportunity to reset. The story of the Transfiguration always precedes Lent because it represents a turning in Jesus' ministry. He's turning the page as well. As he descends the Mount of Transfiguration, he starts his journey towards Jerusalem, to the cross. There are many parallels of the Transfiguration in the Old Testament. We read one today from the book of Exodus. Moses ascends the mountain with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu. Jesus with Peter, James, and John. Moses' companions were not allowed to see God's glory. Jesus' companions were. Moses descends the mountain with his face shining with the Shekinah, or the Chabad. That is the glory of God. Jesus on the mountain is one who transcends Moses. He has within him God's glory, his Shekinah, his Chabad. And we've had a good taste of the Sermon on the Mount in these Sundays after Epiphany. And here is the Christ of God, who on a mountain gave the words of the law, his law. And on that mountain, the people marvel that Jesus speaks not as the scribes, but as one who has authority. Now here he is on another mountain. Peter and the disciples are knocked down by this experience of the glory of Christ. Kind of like the prophet Daniel, in his vision of the Son of Man in Daniel chapter 7. What does this experience mean? First, it is a foretaste of our destiny in Christ. I mentioned last week that we are created in the image and likeness of God. And part of the salvation process in Christ is to restore the image and likeness of God in us. And here's what that image and likeness looks like firsthand in the person of Jesus. Here, Jesus is divine, but he is also showing us humanity in all of its fullness. St. Paul says as much in his letters. From 2 Corinthians, and we all, who with unveiled faces contemplate the Lord's glory, are being transformed into his image with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord who is the Spirit. In the Transfiguration, says Peter Chambers, there is no break, no separation between the divine and the human, the natural and the supernatural, the earthly and the heavenly realities. St. Isaac the Syrian used the phrase, heaven mingled with earth. Gregory of Nyssa wrote, if you wash away the mud that has been put on your heart, the godlike beauty will again shine in you. The Transfiguration shows us the way things ought to be, and what they someday will be for all who believe in Jesus. Transfiguration also shows us that when we are dealing with God, there is a great mercy and mystery surrounding any encounter we have. In this event, there's an unveiling. In this experience of God, there is the holy presence of the heavenly realm. Moses and Elijah appear. Now, of course, symbolically, they represent the law and the prophets. Where did they come from? That'll bake your noodle a little bit, if you think about it. Where were they? Where did they come from? How did they get transformed suddenly to beings that could talk? They're not zombies up there. They're not spirits. There's something very concrete about their appearance. It's a great mystery. Callisto's Ware writes, "The Greek fathers liken a person's encounter with God to the experience of someone walking over the mountains in the mist. One takes a step forward and suddenly finds that they are on the edge of a precipice, with no solid ground beneath their feet, but only a bottomless abyss. Such is the effect of coming face to face with the living mystery of God. We are assailed by dizziness. All the familiar footholds vanish, and there seems nothing for us to grasp. Our inward eyes are blinded, our normal assumptions shattered." We often joke about Peter. He doesn't know anything. Here he is trying to build tents or booths or shrines or whatever it is he's doing. And he wants to build one for Jesus, Moses, and Elijah. Yet he was going back to his knowledge of the people of God. Why wouldn't you try to tabernacle the presence of God? It's what they did in the wilderness, when they were following the cloud and the fire. God said, "Build yourselves a tabernacle, and I will come and meet you there." This is probably what was on Peter's mind. In the temple, the presence of God was there. And here on the mountain, suddenly it's there again. Now, even in medieval times, when you were going to meet a king, the place where you were to meet was called the presence room. Peter wanted to be respectful of his surroundings and create a presence room. An experience of the mystery of God is often something we can only take for what it is. How many of you have seen the movie The Secret Life of Walter Mitty? It's a wonderful movie. And in it, there's a famous photographer named Sean O'Connell. He's on pursuit of a very rare snow leopard in the mountains of Afghanistan. And as he's up there, he finds himself with a perfect shot. All he has to do is click the camera. But he hesitates. He backs away. And what he says about the snow leopard to Walter Mitty is important. It's elusive and hidden from sight because beautiful things don't ask for attention. The disciples are told, "Don't say anything about this to anyone until the story is completely told." As much as God is accessible and present to us in Jesus, he is also elusive and sometimes hidden from our sight. Beautiful things don't ask for attention. Lastly, the take home from this for the disciples and for us is the message God wishes to communicate through the transfiguration. "This is my Son, my beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." Now, if there's any doubt in the disciples' mind that they are dealing with God in the flesh, The Transfiguration puts those doubts to rest. Since that is the case, everything Jesus taught and said was vital for them and is vital for us. As Scott Hosey says, divinity was on display every day of Jesus' life. So we must listen to him. Today we have a baptism. We're bringing a little young fellow into the waters of baptism. And I think of how difficult it is and will be for him to hear the voice of Christ in our world. There are so many messages out there, and they don't just come in the form of ideas. So many images, so many distractions. And there are really two paths, two ways. Augustine called them two cities in his book, The City of God. He was trying to explain to Christians what happens now that Rome has fell. How then should we live? He says this, the two cities have been formed by two loves. The earthly city by the love of self, even to the contempt of God. The heavenly city by the love of God, even to the contempt of self. The former, in a word, glories in itself. The latter glories in the Lord. For the one seeks glory from men, but the greatest glory of the other is God. The task for us as the church is to come beside those who come to the font, those who are married here in our parish, to come beside them and say, follow the city of God. Look for the city of God. We know where the city of man is. Everywhere. It almost feels like it's around us constantly. Constantly in our face. Constantly everywhere we check. When's the last time you saw a show, any kind of show, where the family went to church? So if you were an alien from another planet, you came to the U.S., you went through all of our art and media, would you have any idea what these buildings were for? You wouldn't. Two paths. The city of man, the city of God. This is my beloved son. Listen to him. Seek the city of God.